Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Late last month, the people of Indonesia marked the passing of former President Suharto. He came to power in 1965, and he ruled for more than 30 years before he was swept from office by a wave of popular protest brought on by the Asian financial crisis of 1997. During his time as ruler of Indonesia, the country was widely cited for violations of human rights. President Suharto was criticized for using his position to enrich himself and members of his family. At the same time, Indonesia was thought of as an important friend and ally of the United States during the Cold War. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about Suharto, Indonesia during his time, and perhaps also how Indonesia has changed in the years since. And our guest for the program is Brad Simpson. He is Assistant Professor of U.S. History and Foreign Relations at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And he is particularly interested in the modern history of Indonesia and in U.S.-Indonesian relations. In addition to his teaching and writing, he's also founder and director of an ongoing project to declassify U.S. documents concerning Indonesia and East Timor during the reign of Suharto. This is this period between 1965 and 1998. He's joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for local folks here where we are. And then if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you might happen to be listening over the internet, you use that toll-free line. And again, that's 800-222-9455. Professor Simpson, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
I'm fine.
Well, thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it. Given the fact that I would think, from what I have read about what Indonesia was like under Suharto, that there would be a lot of people who would not be all that saddened at his passing. And I think that, at least from the stories that I read, one might be a little surprised that the way his passing was marked was so respectful. At least there was a national period of mourning declared, and there were people who turned out to see him pass when his body was on his way to burial. Were you surprised at all or should we be surprised at the reaction to his death?
I don't think we should be surprised at the official reaction to his death, which was one of praising him for all of the great things that he allegedly did for his country, and sort of tutting on the side that perhaps there were some controversies about alleged human rights abuses, but nevertheless, think about all the great things that Suharto did for Indonesia's development. If you were paying attention to the Indonesian press and talking to Indonesians, I think a lot of people were really quite indifferent to Suharto's death. And in fact, what wasn't getting a lot of attention, at least here in the United States, was the tremendous outpouring of protest by pro-democracy and human rights organizations who were saddened less about Suharto's death than the fact that he died in a hospital bed rather than in a jail cell, having been convicted of the many crimes for which human rights groups and others had long accused him. The reaction among those who were victimized by the Suharto regime, and they run into the many millions, I think was far less one of praise and admiration than it was of regret that Suharto never faced genuine accountability for his crimes.
Yeah.
And I think the reaction of the U.S. and other Western governments was quite disgraceful in suggesting that there was controversy about these issues as if we have been merely a watchful bystander rather than an active participant in many of these crimes.
Yeah, and I think it's worth underscoring the fact that to the day that he died, there were people in Indonesia who believed that he should be put on trial. He should be held accountable for everything that happened during the time that he was president, and also that he should be held to account for all of the money that went into his accounts and into the accounts of members of his family as various kinds of goodies were handed out to people who were close to him.
Yes, as Suharto died, the Indonesian government was moving forward with one of a number of lawsuits against Suharto, which we have yet to see if these lawsuits will continue against his children or not. But the Indonesian government had effectively sued Suharto to recover somewhere in the neighborhood of $580 million that the Indonesian government alleged Suharto stole from state foundations that Suharto had founded and put in his name. This, of course, is just the tip of the iceberg. Estimates from independent scholars, from the United Nations, from non-governmental organizations such as Transparency International, Ray Suharto is perhaps the greatest kleptocrat of the 20th century, and have concluded that he stole perhaps up to $35 billion over the course of his 32-year reign. Quite a lot more, perhaps double that, if you take into account the billions of dollars that he funneled to his children, to his military and non-military cronies, money which should have gone to helping the people of Indonesia rather than lining the pockets of his supporters.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit about how it is that he came to power. He was the second president of Indonesia after independence. It had been a Dutch colony, then occupied by the Japanese. Then after World War II, another man named Sukarno, he declared independence. He became the president. Then there was a coup, and at that point, Suharto came to power.
Yeah, we have to go back to the period following World War II and remember what a country like Indonesia was like. It had been a colony of the Dutch for several hundred years. It was enormously poor. There were very few educated Indonesians who had the skills and training to help run a modern economy and to help run a modern state. And Sukarno, who was one of the most charismatic leaders of the post-war period, was also a very fervent nationalist. He was a staunch anti-colonialist, and he was one of the leaders of what became known as the Non-Aligned Movement, this grouping of newly independent states that thought they shouldn't be forced to choose sides in the Cold War and should be allowed to pursue their own path in their political and economic development. And Sukarno really grated under the skin of American officials because he refused to take sides in the Cold War and thought that he should be allowed to accept assistance from any country that was willing to give it. He refused to put down the Communist Party and thought that the Communist Party, which in Indonesia was a legal party, should actually be allowed to function rather than being banned or its leaders imprisoned or killed, as was happening in many other countries. In 1957 and 1958, the United States actually sponsored a covert operation aimed at overthrowing Sukarno that ended up sparking a brief but very bloody civil war in which the forces backed by the United States attempted to break up the Republic of Indonesia. And Sukarno, along with loyal elements of the Indonesian armed forces, ended up crushing this rebellion. And in fact, this attempted overthrow of Sukarno actually bolstered the political power of the Indonesian Communist Party and made a lot of Indonesians convinced that the United States was not, in fact, looking out for its best interests, but was quite willing to sponsor covert operations, civil wars, even try and break up the country in order to achieve its political goals. And this was a legacy that the United States never really lived down. And over the course of the next 6 years, relations between the United States and Sukarno steadily worsened as Sukarno came out in opposition to the Vietnam War, as he challenged the rights of foreign investors, including American oil companies, which he argued were exploiting the resources of Indonesia. And finally, we come to what became known as the September 30th, 1965 movement, which was an alleged coup attempt that Suharto, who was then a lieutenant general, used as sort of an excuse for overthrowing Sukarno and coming to power.
Mm. This was one in when a number of generals were killed, apparently, and there's some question about, or is there some question about whether, in fact, Mr. Suharto had anything to do with this? Was he somebody who might have actually been on this list also to be killed, and he was just lucky to survive? Is it exactly clear what happened at that point?
Well, Suharto in 1965 was viewed by most Indonesians as a relatively apolitical general. He was not someone widely admired for his political skills. He just had a knack for being in the right place at the right time. He was named as the commander of several military operations that Sukarno had pursued in the 1960s, including an operation to try and get the territory of West Papua back from the Dutch and return it to the Indonesian fold. But Suharto was largely judged as a neutral person when it came to the Indonesian Communist Party, and was viewed as someone who was likely to simply stand aside when disaffected elements of the Indonesian armed forces kidnapped and eventually murdered six members of the Indonesian high command. Now, this took place after more than a year of quite intensive U.S. and British covert operations, which aimed at sowing political and economic instability in Indonesia, in the very hopes of trying to provoke the Indonesian Communist Party into launching what U.S. officials hoped would be a failed coup attempt that might serve as a justification for the Indonesian army wiping out the Communist Party and overthrowing Sukarno. And it's my belief, although I think the jury is still out on this, that this is indeed what happened, that along with lots of very complicated internal political struggles taking place within Indonesia in 1965, that the United States and the government of Great Britain, in fact, were engaged in covert operations that aimed to provoke the Indonesian Communist Party to essentially play its hand and put itself out there in a way that might justify the Indonesian army trying to get rid of it. And a number of Indonesian officials who were involved in the September 30th movement, in fact, have said that they informed then-Lieutenant General Suharto of their plans, and that he was judged agnostic or even supportive of these efforts to overthrow members of the Indonesian high command, whom they argued were getting ready to overthrow Sukarno. And so, as he had in many other points in his career, Suharto was in the right place at the right time, and he used this alleged coup attempt, as one historian put it, as a pretext for mass murder, and eventually named himself the head of the army, and then launched a massive wave of killings that went on for the next 6 months.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Brad Simpson. He is assistant professor of U.S. history and foreign relations at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and is interested in Indonesia, its modern history, and particularly in U.S.-Indonesian relations. And we are talking about Indonesia, particularly here concentrating on the time of the rule of President Suharto, who ruled the country for more than 30 years until popular unrest brought on by the Asian financial crisis of the late 90s drove him from office. He died at the end of January, on January 27th. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to stay for a moment with the subject of the relationship between Indonesia and the United States at this point, and the fact that for a long time the United States supported Suharto because they did consider him to be an important ally, an anti-communist ally. This was during the Cold War. Just how important to Mr. Suharto staying in power all that time was American support?
Well, American support was indispensable from the very moment that Suharto came to power. When he came to power in October of 1965, he immediately launched a massive campaign of killings against alleged members of the Indonesian Communist Party, in which somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Indonesians were killed in the space of about 6 months. So this is, you know, about the same scale and scope as the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. And this was done with the political, economic, and, in fact, covert military support of the United States, as well as other Western governments. And the United States and other governments made it clear that if Suharto was going to get their support, that he needed to toe the line on foreign policy issues that were important to us. And this meant stopping what American officials viewed as the harassment of foreign corporations and allowing Western investors to come back in on friendly terms, stopping criticism of the Vietnam War, and generally reorienting Indonesia's economy and foreign policy towards the West. In return for this, the United States became one of Indonesia's largest military and political and economic backers. averaging somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million in economic assistance every year, and emerging in the early 1970s as the single largest provider of military training and weapons for the Indonesian Armed Forces. In fact, when Indonesia invades East Timor in December of 1965 with the support of the Gerald Ford administration, about 95% of the Indonesian Army's weapons were provided by the United States. And throughout this period, the United States was the indispensable sort of backstop of support for the Suharto regime. And really, it was a withdrawal of U.S. support in the spring of 1998 in the wake of the Asian financial crisis that really, I would suggest, was the death knell for Suharto and convinced disaffected elements of the armed forces that viewed Suharto as bringing Indonesia to the brink of collapse, convinced them to finally push him out and allow a civilian government to take over.
Mm-hmm. Can one point directly to anything that the Suharto government either did or didn't do to precipitate that conflict or to make Indonesia's, the way that it was touched by that, worse? Can you really say that by making bad decisions or not making decisions that that the Indonesian government really had a role in that?
In which conflict?
I'm thinking of in the financial crisis and what that meant for Indonesia.
Well, we'd have to sort of go back a little and look at the way that Suharto structured the Indonesian economy. The Indonesian economy was very dependent upon foreign investment, and Suharto ran Indonesia the way that a mafia don might run his business dealings. Indonesia's economy was sort of a giant Ponzi scheme for foreign investors that was deeply dependent upon foreign currency. And when foreign investors began to doubt the stability of the Indonesian economy after a period of rushing in the early to mid-1990s to take advantage of repressed labor, low wages, lax environmental laws, and other sort of inviting legal framework that foreign investors thought was quite friendly to foreign investors, when it appeared that the economic stability of Indonesia was being threatened by the Asian financial crisis, this massive tide of foreign investment simply flowed right out, and Indonesia's economy collapsed like a house of cards. And really, in the 32-year period of the U.S. relationship with Indonesia, really the winter and spring of 1998 in the wake of the financial crisis is the only time that the U.S. government ever really used its maximum leverage to pressure Indonesia. It could have done so at any time during this 32-year period to support pro-democracy and human rights activists, but instead it was the Clinton administration that during this time in the winter and spring of 1998 finally used its full leverage with the Indonesian government not to pressure for human rights and democracy, but to press Indonesia to knuckle under and accept a stabilization package that was being demanded by the International Monetary Fund that had a pretty devastating impact on the Indonesian people, especially the urban poor. And when this program was accepted by President Suharto, and there's a very famous picture of him signing this agreement while Michael Candices, the acting director of the International Monetary Fund, sort of stands looking over his shoulder, this indeed helped to spark the mass protest among Indonesia's poor, as well as among students and quietly some members of the armed forces, that resulted in his overthrow in May of 1998.
I wanted to have you talk about Timor, and maybe first just talk about Suharto's involvement in that decision. Maybe it was his decision, in fact, to annex East Timor after, this was in the mid-70s, after the Portuguese had left. It had been a Portuguese colony. Was that, in fact, his decision?
This was a decision that was pushed upon Suharto by some of his chief military advisors. Through the fall of 1975, Portugal's authoritarian government was overthrown in the fall of 1974, and Indonesia did not invade until nearly a year later. And throughout this period, between late 1974 and 1975, elements of the Indonesian armed forces were pressing Suharto to forcibly annex East Timor, suggesting that this newly independent country or that a newly independent country on Indonesia's border, which was likely to be ruled by a relatively progressive, maybe even leftist government, which was nationalist and might conceivably give funny ideas to other parts of the Indonesian archipelago about the possibilities for freedom and democracy, the Indonesian military considered this absolutely unacceptable. And they began sounding out the U.S. government and the governments of Australia, Great Britain, and other Western powers almost a year before the invasion. And Suharto was a cautious man. He was not a particularly daring military or political leader, and he was deeply fearful that if he invaded East Timor, that the United States Congress might cut off weapons sales and military training for Indonesia. And it was precisely his fear that an illegal invasion of East Timor would lead to a cutoff of U.S. economic and military assistance that Suharto resisted pressure from the Indonesian armed forces to invade East Timor until December of 1975. And it was only after receiving explicit permission and explicit support from Gerald Ford and then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger that Suharto indeed launched the invasion. But for more than a year before, the United States had monitored Indonesia's creeping campaign of first political pressure and then outright terrorism and military operations that led up to the invasion on December 7th, 1975.
Mm-hmm. And then, so Indonesia occupied Timor from 1975 until 1999, and this was a time when there continued to be a very strong independence movement, a strong desire for independence on the part of most of the people, I think, of East Timor. Hundreds of thousands of people died during this time that Indonesia occupied Timor.
Yeah, if we look at the legacy of mass murder and killing that Suharto left behind, surely he rates as one of the great mass murderers of modern history, certainly right up there with Pol Pot and some of the great butchers of the last half century. Not only did Suharto oversee the killing of somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 Indonesians in 1965, he also, after annexing illegally the territory of West Papua in 1969, helped to oversee military operations that led to the deaths of perhaps 100,000 people in West Papua, something which Yale University's Genocide Documentation Project has labeled an act of genocide. Likewise, in East Timor, between 1975 and 1999, most intensively between 1975 and 1983, Indonesia engaged in a campaign of mass murder and enforced starvation that led to the deaths of somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 East Timorese, somewhere between one-sixth and one-third of the East Timorese population. And proportionally speaking, this is perhaps the worst genocide since the Holocaust, and certainly ranks up there with the genocide in Rwanda, Cambodia, and many other episodes of mass murder in the last half century. And this was carried out with the full military and political support of the United States and other Western powers. From the very moment that Indonesia invaded East Timor, the United States was aware of what it was doing. It was aware that this was illegal, and it was aware that Indonesia was doing so almost entirely with U.S. weapons. Less than a week after the invasion, the National Security Council received a top-secret memorandum, which we have declassified, which detailed weapon by weapon all of the American arms which were being used by the Indonesian forces that invaded East Timor. The paratroopers that flooded into East Timor in the initial hours of the invasion were jumping from American-supplied C-130 aircraft. Their jump masters were American-trained. They were carrying American-supplied rifles. Almost everything they had was, in fact, supplied by the United States. And far from viewing Indonesia's illegal use of American weapons as a justification for cutting supplies to the Indonesian armed forces, both the Ford and later the Carter administration nearly doubled the flow of weapons to Indonesia at precisely the moment when foreign observers were beginning to characterize what was happening in East Timor as, in fact, a genocide.
We are at our midpoint here, and I just would like to introduce again for anyone who might have tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes, introduce our guest, Brad Simpson. He is Assistant Professor of U.S. History and Foreign Relations at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and is interested in the modern history of Indonesia and also in U.S.-Indonesian relations, particularly during this time when the country was ruled by General Suharto from 1965 until 1998. In addition to his teaching writing research, he's also the founder and director of an ongoing project to declassify U.S. documents concerning Indonesia and East Timor during this time. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a moment, I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about what's going on now in Timor. It has been in the news recently because there was apparently an attempted coup. At least there was an attempt on the life of both the president, José Ramos Horta, and also the Xanana Gusmão, who's the prime minister. Mr. Gusmão was apparently not hurt. Mr. Ramos Horta was seriously injured. What was this about?
Well, this is a very complicated political situation in East Timor that many foreign observers have blamed on regional tensions between the western and the eastern half of the island of East Timor. The man who was responsible for this action, Alfredo Reynado, who was killed in his attempt to assassinate José Ramos Horta and Xanana Gusmão, is a disaffected member, former member of the East Timorese Armed Forces, who in May of 2006 led an uprising, which was allegedly in response to resentment over low pay, over the lack of political representation among the eastern half of the island, the half island of East Timor. But I think Reynado's support, such as it was, and Reynado had no real political program. He was not a revolutionary. He was not proposing a wide-ranging program of economic or political reform. I think this was largely an attempt by a disaffected member of the armed forces who was seeking personal power and trying to rally other members of the East Timorese armed forces to his side. But nevertheless, Reynado's actions reflect real disillusionment and real resentment with the pace of economic growth in East Timor, with the lack of economic and political progress that has existed in East Timor since independence of May of 2002, with the lack of successful anti-poverty efforts and efforts to use the revenues from oil resources that East Timor has begun to receive in the last couple of years to actually improve the lives of East Timor's overwhelmingly poor rural majority. And although Reynado himself, the gentleman who was killed in his attempts to assassinate Mr. Horta and former President Xanana Gusmão, although he himself did not represent a mass movement, I think in some ways, although I obviously disagree vigorously with what he was doing and the actions which he took, I think he reflected the disillusionment and resentment that a lot of East Timorese have that 5 years after independence, that the living standard of most people in East Timor has not improved all that much, and that there's a lot of corruption in East Timor. The armed forces and the police oftentimes engage in what can only be described as harsh and sometimes abusive tactics against nonviolent protesters. And after being under Indonesian occupation for 24 years and being subjected to corrupt and brutal military occupation and an economic occupation that stole the resources of East Timor for the benefit of the Indonesian army and for the benefit of Suharto and his family, I think there is a legacy of corruption and authoritarianism among certain elements of Indonesia's government and armed forces that has provoked justifiable resentment among many people in East Timor. It's a deeply disturbing situation, a deeply saddening situation, but I think that East Timor's people have not necessarily been very well served either by the successive governments that had been in place and even more so by the international community, which supported Indonesia's invasion and occupation of East Timor and has not done a whole lot to try and help the people of East Timor develop economically since their independence.
All right. Well, we have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Champaign County here where we are. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. Just a personal aside. First, Ramos Horta was in the area. General Rowanto, who I think tried to run for presidency and was one of the cronies and may have been the architect of the invasion of Indonesia. I'm not sure on that. But he owned a lot in the U.S. as well as corporate capture of the state of Indonesia. And some words about Freeport-McMoRan might be in order. But Ramos Horta came in and did a talk before the locked out workers in Charleston at, I believe it was called Fleet Mobile or something.
The episode that you're referring to, I was actually the one who brought José Ramos Horta down to Charleston, Illinois. And at the time, there was a company called Trailmobile, which was located in Charleston. This was a time of the sort of wars taking place in southern Illinois. And Trailmobile was owned by the Wanandi family, which was a family in Indonesia which was very closely tied to the invasion of East Timor. Joseph Wanandi was one of the founders of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Indonesia, which is a military-led think tank. And his brother was the CEO of this company, Trailmobile, which is the world's largest producer or manufacturer of refrigerated tractor trailers. And the Trailmobile lockout, in which hundreds of Trailmobile employees were locked out of their jobs over a contract dispute, was actually a quite inspiring example of international solidarity, because we brought José Ramos Horta down to Charleston to meet with some of the representatives of the Trailmobile struggle. And we talked to them, and José Ramos Horta talked to them about what had happened in East Timor, about the connections between the owner of the Trailmobile factory and the human rights abuses that had taken place in East Timor. And I'll never forget listening to Mr. Horta speak with one of the locked-out employees, and he said, I get the sense that if Mr. Wanandi had his way, he would, rather than locking us up, much rather line us up in a ditch and simply shoot us all like his brother has helped to do for the people of East Timor. And it was really illustrative of the intimate connections that one can make between economic issues here in the United States that often seem very remote from foreign policy and the struggle of the people of East Timor, which seem very remote from the concerns of those who are locked out of the Trailmobile factory. But José Ramos Horta is a person who was able to make those connections. And there were a lot of other connections that people in this country have made between American corporations and human rights abuses taking place in Indonesia and East Timor. The caller mentioned the activities of Freeport-McMoRan, which is one of the world's largest mining companies, which operates some of the largest gold and copper mines in the world in the territory of West Papua, which is the western half of the island of New Guinea. Indonesia illegally annexed West Papua in 1969, conveniently at a moment when then-President Richard Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger were visiting Indonesia on Kissinger's first foreign trip after being elected president. And Henry Kissinger went on to join the board of Freeport-McMoRan. And for the last several decades, Freeport-McMoRan has been operating in West Papua. There's been a long-running independence movement in West Papua, which has been sparked in part by resentment at the exploitation of Freeport-McMoRan and the Indonesian armed forces of the indigenous people of West Papua. And this is a similar dynamic to what we see taking place in many countries in the world, where foreign corporations, sometimes U.S., ally with repressive military establishments to essentially exploit the people of the area, and in doing so often spark independence or secessionist movements whose resentment of human rights abuses and economic exploitation, in fact, are traceable directly to the operations of foreign corporations.
Returning to the dissatisfaction of the people in Timor right now, how much of that do you attribute to one of the aspects of it could be the fact that the compromise that had to be agreed to by both Horta and the Prime Minister in sort of this eventual negotiation had to do with being business friendly, and particularly I was thinking about the oil concession in the Timor Gap that Australian companies got, if I recall correctly, and that I mean, Australia is seen as some kind of liberator at this point, but in some ways they're trying to could be seen, I guess, as trying to at least clamp the lid on the status quo. So that were those concessions ever renegotiated, and was that part of a package? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, this was the caller's referring to the oil resources that lie off the coast of East Timor. When Indonesia invaded East Timor in 1975, it signed an agreement with Australia to jointly exploit the oil resources of the Timor Gap. This is an illegal agreement that when East Timor became independent in 2002, it began renegotiating, calling for renegotiations of this agreement with the Australian government. And Indonesia had actually signed a bad agreement. The Suharto regime was so desperate to gain some international acceptance of its annexation of East Timor that it, in fact, signed a very poor agreement with the Australian government that left Australian companies in control of the bulk of the oil and natural gas resources that lay off the coast of East Timor. And when East Timor became independent, it was in a very difficult position. Its nearest neighbor was the country which had invaded and subjugated it for a quarter of a century. Its next closest neighbor was the only country in the world which had actually recognized the invasion and occupation of East Timor as having legal legitimacy. And all of the countries upon which East Timor depended for foreign aid and for political survival were the very countries that had supported Indonesia's invasion and occupation. And so the East Timorese government made what I think are understandable efforts to try and make nice with the very countries which have been responsible for the enormous suffering of the East Timorese people. I may disagree with some of the decisions that the East Timorese government made, but they're nevertheless understandable given that East Timor was small and enormously poor and really didn't have a lot of political leverage to try and demand justice and accountability from the countries that had supported its invasion and occupation by Indonesia for 24 years. There are other sort of technical disputes that relate to how the East Timorese government uses the oil revenues which it is entitled to under this new agreement with Australia. A lot of East Timorese believe that the government should be using these resources to try and build up infrastructure to engage in a massive program to try and reduce poverty and increase employment for Timorese. But the government has decided for its own reasons to try and create what's called a sovereign wealth fund, as we have heard about in the news with other countries, that would essentially sort of sock this money away for a rainy day rather than using it to try and meet the more immediate economic needs of the people of East Timor.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Brad Simpson. He is Assistant Professor of U.S. History and Foreign Relations at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And we're talking about Indonesia. He's interested in modern Indonesian history and in U.S.-Indonesian relations. He's also founder and director of an ongoing project to declassify U.S. documents concerning Indonesia and East Timor during the reign of General Suharto. That was the period between 1965 and 1998. And we've been talking a lot about that. Also, we want to talk a little bit here about contemporary Indonesia today. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And I guess I do want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about the current Indonesian government and the current president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, who's been president now for about 3 years or so, since the fall of 2004, said to be the first peaceful transition of power ever in the history of the country. What would you say about him?
Well, Yudhoyono is a U.S.-trained Army officer. He was actually trained at Fort Leavenworth in the United States. He was one of a generation of Indonesian Army officers that really sort of came of age after Suharto had come to power, and he is considered a moderate among many in the West, especially in the United States, in that his first response to political turmoil is not to simply arrest or massacre those who are protesting. And I guess in that respect, he is an improvement upon Suharto and many of those around him. But I think it's worth noting that the Indonesian political system right now is thoroughly dominated by the political parties and political figures, both in the government and in the so-called opposition, that were around when Suharto was in power. The entire process, the entire political process in Indonesia, all the people involved, are all holdovers, leftovers from the New Order regime of General Suharto. It's as if someone had sort of opened the door after Suharto was ousted and sort of let all the horses out of the corral, and now we see a lot of his former cronies sort of freelancing, starting their own political parties, and engaging in a sort of uncontrolled form of corruption rather than the tightly controlled form of corruption that Suharto practiced when he was in power. And although Indonesia has a formal democratic system, it has all the procedures of democracy, it doesn't have any of the responsiveness, any of the representativeness that we would expect from a healthy democratic system. There are free and fair elections, but there is not a real effective rule of law in Indonesia right now. One of the things that Suharto did quite effectively was to demolish all of the independent institutions of government and civil society, especially the judiciary, that are necessary for democracy to really take hold and flourish. And if you look at the judiciary, if you look at the level of corruption in Indonesia, if you look at the level of investment in infrastructure and education and healthcare in Indonesia, I think it's quite clear that Indonesia is still struggling mightily to recover from the disastrous developmental and economic legacy of Suharto, and Indonesia still has a long way to go. I'm not at all optimistic about Indonesia's economic or political prospects, given the current structure of Indonesian politics. Indonesia is still an oligarchy. It still has a very elite-driven political system, and it's not a fully functioning democracy in the sense that the interests of the poor majority of Indonesia are actually represented. What, in fact, we have is an elite democratic system in which a lot of parties controlled by former cronies of Suharto and those who clustered around them are engaging in a political show that doesn't really do much to improve the living standards of Indonesia's majority of people.
Well, we're getting short on time here, but I have another caller I want to include, so we'll get to them in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. A great show. It sounds to me like your guest just described democracy in America, elitism and all that. Well, what I called for was two things. A question for your guest. Is he acting as an academic or just a reporter? And the depredations that the West, in general, has carried on around the world appears to me to be of some of the highest crimes that can be attributed to anyone in a long term. We keep references to the Holocaust and all those things and these people who died there, which was a horror in and of itself. But when you begin to add up them, as your guest has said, the millions upon millions of people who have been massacred, put to death. Today's news, right on NPR, indicated 15 indigenous peoples in one of the South American countries were killed by loggers, and they chopped their heads off. No opposition. We want the logs. We get them. You die. Well, that same paradigm, to me, seems to be extant all throughout the system of what we now endure called capitalism. Can you answer those, sir?
Well, that's quite a broad question. Let me answer the easy one first. I am an academic historian, but I also direct a project through the National Security Archive called the Indonesia and East Timor Documentation Project, which tries to serve a more public function. we declassify and make available formerly secret U.S. documents concerning human rights abuses, military relations with Indonesia during the reign of Suharto. And the explicit purpose of this project is to make these documents available to the public and to human rights and non-governmental organizations so that they can engage in more journalistic and human rights-related activities that will actually have some impact on contemporary discussions about Indonesian human rights and democracy. We gave more than 5,000 pages of documents, for example, to East Timor's Truth Commission between 2002 and 2005, which they used to help write their report. And right now I'm also in discussion and working with a number of Indonesian human rights organizations to give them U.S. documents concerning corruption and human rights abuses in Indonesia so that they can help to recover some of their own history and make these documents available to the Indonesian public. On the sort of broader question that the caller raised, I think that one example might suffice to make more concrete the kinds of concerns that the caller raised. Right now, everyone is reading and hearing a lot about the so-called biofuel boom in the United States and other countries. Indonesia is also experiencing the rather harmful effects of this so-called biofuels boom in that there's a tremendous demand for palm oil in the same way that there's a tremendous demand for ethanol here in the United States. And so illegal logging is wiping out many of Indonesia's remaining forests as former and current military officers, corrupt businessmen and politicians are pushing poor and landless people off their lands in order to plant palm oil trees that can be used to grow the plants that produce palm oil for biofuels. At the same time, Indonesia's environment is being ravaged by these programs. Indonesia is very much plugged into this global demand for so-called ecologically friendly fuels. But without a real democratic system of accountability in place, it's Indonesia's poor and its landless who are being forced to pay the price for this global demand of biofuels. And they're certainly not the ones who are benefiting from this rush to try and cut down the forest and to grow palm oil. But I think it's fairly indicative of a kind of functionally undemocratic, but in practice undemocratic, political and economic system, which Indonesia continues to struggle with nearly a decade after Suharto's ouster.
We're down to the point where we have about 2 minutes left. We have spent a little bit of time talking about Timor and about the fact that after a long period of time, Timor did become independent after a lot of violence and a lot of bloodshed. I think there were people elsewhere in Indonesia that look to Timor as perhaps a sense of encouragement in that independence is possible, and certainly, and there are strong independence movements in other places like West Papua and Aceh, just to name two. Do you think that in the future this is going to be something that is going to be a continuing challenge to the Indonesian government, that is, dealing with people who are going to be demanding, if not independence, then at least greater autonomy?
Well, demands for independence and autonomy in Indonesia have been directly tied to human rights abuses and economic exploitation. If Indonesia's politics and economy become more democratic, more representative, and if the benefits of resource extraction and the like actually flow to the people of places like West Papua and Aceh, then I imagine that demands for independence or greater autonomy would actually decrease. But as long as the military remains a political as well as an economic force in Indonesia, and particularly in those places, as long as the people of those regions do not see the resources or the benefits from economic development, then I think it's very likely that demands for independence and for autonomy and self-determination will continue. Indonesia's territorial integrity, I think, is really dependent upon the majority of Indonesia's people believing that they have a stake and actually see some benefits from Indonesia remaining a unified country. And I think that this is a question which is still very much up in the air.
We're pretty much at the point that we're going to have to stop. And obviously, we have covered an awful lot of ground. Is there some last sort of thing that you'd like to leave people with, particularly those people to whom the recent history of Indonesia is something that's new?
Well, I would urge people to look at the website of the Indonesia East Timor Documentation Project. You can go to the website or Google the National Security Archive, which is located at George Washington University. And right there on the front page, there's a link to a declassified documentary obituary that we wrote for Suharto, which contains U.S. documents. You can click on that link and then find links to the Indonesia East Timor Documentation Project homepage and find dozens and dozens of documents concerning U.S.-Indonesian relations during the Suharto period that will give listeners a much better sense of the ways in which the United States helped to underwrite one of the most brutal and corrupt leaders of the last half century.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for the calls.
Our guest is Brad Simpson. He is Assistant Professor of U.S. History and Foreign Relations at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.